This is the London FinTech Podcast, bringing you practical insights and approaches, stories and inspiration from the innovators who are building the new world of financial services. Welcome to London FinTech Podcast. Today's conversation is about the 5.5 million small to medium businesses in the UK, something of FinTech in the aftermath of the financial crisis and the journey in the 14 years since. We're talking about business lending, machine learning, FinTech and incumbent collaboration models. My guest today is Christoph Riecher, CEO and co-founder of iWalker. Welcome, Christoph. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's good to be here. This is a conversation I've been really looking forward to, as it's a fast forward from the fintech era of 15 years ago. With all the current AI excitement, we sometimes forget that many innovative fintechs have been running for over a decade. The disruption era of neobank and lending startups following the financial crisis has evolved to what some are now calling the great rebundling, and some of the earlier innovations have matured to new competition models, where they're quite like unusual collaboration models, perhaps between incumbents and new entrants to the market. And we're seeing embedded lending, embedded payments, some of those models maturing. And it's a lot that I think we might uncover in today's conversation. So before we get into talking about the iWalker business and the founder's journey in a bit more depth, Christoph, can you tell us a little bit about your early years and background and how you came to be building iWalker?
Yeah, of course. Very happy to. I started my career at Goldman Sachs and spent there 7 years on the market side, which was a tremendous learning experience to really understand how markets are functioning across all of the different asset classes, working with very talented and ambitious people. And over the years, I felt that there was something missing in my day-to-day job. I wanted to have a stronger impact on individuals rather than working on the sort of grand sort of financial markets where, you know, arguably obviously had very little impact on how they'd be moving. And I think that was sort of the start of my desire to start my own business and define my own fate and build something with my own hands.
You really wanted to get closer, perhaps on a slightly more individual personal level. I understand that broad markets, you're looking at a screen and there's a lot of numbers moving around, but you're not really connecting with people. So perhaps more of the individual connection there.
Yeah, it's sort of direct translation of the work that you're doing and how it impacts the world. And I just felt that, you know, I wanted to have a stronger connection to the people that I impact than I could have being on the broad financial markets. And so, yeah, that was really kind of, I think, sort of like the inner desire in me to start my own company. And then I started researching what I could be doing, started to look for problems that I could solve. And came quite quickly on the big challenge that small businesses had in accessing financing. This was towards the end of the Great Financial Recession. It was very publicly debated that small businesses didn't have the access to finance that they needed to make investments and grow their business. And in many cases, actually, even not to trade through shorter term cash flow problems. And that in, you know, many cases did lead to the company having to wind down as a small business with relatively little reserves. You can enter quite quickly into a downward spiral. And I felt that was a fascinating and really important problem to solve. I liked, first of all, the fact that I could give an individual business owner the funds that they need to pursue, you know, in some parts, their dreams to grow their business, and others just to sleep better at night, to have the funds available to pay their supplier and their staff and to continue to run their business. So, you know, the desire that I was earlier speaking about was really kind of, you know, very, very present in that challenge, that by providing them the funds that I have this impact on an individual that I was lacking very much working on global financial markets. The second bit I found really exciting about this opportunity is that there are millions of small businesses. You were referring to 5.5 million in the UK. If you go broader in Europe, there are more than 20 million small businesses. So it's a huge market. So if I can help fund not just one customer, but do it a million times over, then I can actually have some impact even on the macro level in a way that, you know, I didn't have before. And the third bit that really won me over is that there was a lot of evolution in the years running up to our starting the business. And that was the emergence of APIs through which you could access data in a way that wasn't possible before. And then also new techniques to process that data and build better credit models. So I felt like all three points were incredibly compelling. And then I decided to give it a go.
Yeah. So personal, individual impact, almost addressable market opportunity, and maturing technology and API capabilities sort of coming together there. You've certainly had an impact since. So if I'm right, iWalker is on a mission to finance 1 million businesses. So maybe let's touch on that. What size is the business now in terms of customers and loan books and countries that you serve?
Yeah, but before I answer that question, you know, the fourth one that came together is that I found an absolutely amazing co-founder that complemented me 100%. You know, both of us are still very active into the business, but as you're starting sort of on a journey like this, you know, your early partners that you choose absolutely defining of the success. So I think that was the fourth one. Also, you know, from the start, had a team as small as just the two of us and to really make it happen. I think that's something that I will really highlight as the sort of core foundation of iWalker.
Yeah, as we often discuss on this show, you know, starting something up is a team sport, and it's crucial to have a complementary team of founders and bring those different skill sets together in order to drive something. It's almost impossible. You can have it. There's a lot of ideas out there, but the hard work that goes into execution, you really need a team. So I think it was. Is it James, your co-founder, was with you right at the beginning?
Yes. So James has been there from day zero and still going strongly 15 years on.
And you're still there. Okay. So yes, I asked you about the size of the business and where you've come to. So love to hear that.
Before we jump right into today's episode, a quick thank you to our sponsor, NextWave. NextWave is an award-winning consultancy that is helping many of the world's leading banks, investment managers, and insurers deliver on their growth, efficiency, risk, and control goals and transform their businesses. With a senior team who have come from MD-level positions in major firms like HSBC, Barclays, and UBS, NextWave has both the deep industry expertise and the hands-on capabilities in AI, data, and automation to drive real results. More business outcomes and less PowerPoint from the consulting experience, as their clients like to say. NextWave has moved 2-week manual processes to 5-minute agentic automations, rescued global banking regulatory control programs, and digitized deal platforms, sustainability, and regulatory reporting systems. And they do much of this with hands-on engineering capabilities on leading technologies, which include ServiceNow, Alteryx, Quantexa, and Komunda. So if a modern and specialist alternative to the big brand consulting model sounds appealing, one which covers the full life cycle of strategy specialists and solutions, but with small practitioner teams, rapid delivery, and a better price point, then perhaps you should talk to NextWave. Visit nxwave.com to find out more and get in touch. That's nxwave.com. All right, let's get back to the episode.
Yeah, it's been a roller coaster, right? Sort of from the outset, we saw this as a sort of global opportunity. And, you know, the starting point was we want to be operating in 75 countries, lending across the world. And, you know, over the last 15 years, we made it to two markets that are very successful for us. We've been in four at a maximum, but decided that more focus is required in getting it right in those two markets. That's the UK and Germany. In both of those, we have grown to quite considerable scale. We're now funding probably about 5,000-6,000 businesses every month. We have originated more than £1.5 billion across those markets over the last 12 months. And you know, as I said, one of the sort of things that, you know, I felt really exciting was that I can have an impact on a macro level as well. And we've now started to measure how much economic activity our financing is supporting. And, you know, the estimate is about more than 2 times of our lending amount. So over the last 12 months, we have added about £3.5 billion to the economy and created some 60,000 jobs. So I think, you know, that's sort of really, for me as a founder and for the entire team, really motivating that we have delivered sort of on these 3 points, a massive impact on many small businesses to really add scale to create economic activity. And we'll be speaking a bit more about the tech and how we're using data. But, you know, that's been a really exciting area where we innovated a lot.
I love that measuring the market and the real world impact as a multiple of the funding that you provide, because that's really the end point with this. It's creating jobs, growing the economy, creating opportunities in the markets. iWalker. So I gather, and I think your comms team put me straight on this in the research. I thought it was something else, but it's instant working capital, if I'm right.
And, yeah.
And that's pretty much your mission. I think you're underwriting loans and providing funds inside 24 hours.
Yeah, and our personal best is 2 minutes and 37 seconds.
Okay.
A business starting the application process to actually having money credited into their bank account. That specific customer was a customer that is banking with Tide. And so through our API integration with Tide, they were able to share the information that we need to make a decision. And so that really does accelerate or represent as real-time application to funding capability that we have built. So yes, we in more than 80% of the cases, our customers receive instant credit decisions that they can then use to draw funding from us.
And when you were starting out, this idea of real-time underwriting, instant working capital, really out-underwriting the high street banks who might take days or weeks to make a similar decision, or perhaps not even interested in that loan size at all. But what reaction were you getting from market? Were there people saying to you, there's no way this is going to work, or was it a very quick adoption and product market fit?
Well, nothing is quick, 15 years on. And, it's been quite the journey that we've gone through. But businesses, of course, absolutely love the speed and certainty that we can give. If you're a business owner, you kind of juggle a lot of balls at the same time. It's really draining to ask someone for funding and having to do this over many, many weeks without the certainty whether you can actually get it or not, whether you kind of invest the time, your sparse time into a process that doesn't go anywhere. It's very frustrating. The barriers that we have broken down through the technology and the experience that we provide today is been an absolute fresh breath of fresh air for businesses and game changing for many. So businesses can now, literally, if they get offered a stock, for example, from the supplier at a good price, but they don't necessarily have the funds, they can really react within the same day to buy that stock and pay for it. While in the past, in many cases, they would have had to pass because, if they get funding in 4 to 6 weeks, the deal would obviously be long gone. So for many businesses, really this sort of speed of access and certainty is game changing.
Yeah. And you said that it's been a roller coaster. And for many businesses, including my consulting business, one of the big rides on that particular roller coaster was COVID. The government, UK government, launched a bounce back loan scheme that many firms relied on to survive at the time. There's been a lot of issues in the aftermath of that with lending decisions, but all of the big lenders were scrambling to provide the bounce back loans. Were you involved in all of that? And what were you seeing from the inside?
Yeah, it was a roller coaster for everybody, Starting with our customers, of course, they were heavily impacted like everyone else, and then us as a result. Government over those 2 years or so provided, I think, more than £50 billion in liquidity to SMEs. It was one of the largest funding years, I think, to SMEs on record. And we were directly participating in the schemes that the government offered. And we were accredited for the CBILS scheme, the Coronavirus Business Interruption Loan Scheme. We're one of the largest funders under that scheme and therefore really supporting businesses in that difficult period of time. Also saw a sharp reduction from some of our customers in requesting funding from us as the bounce back loan scheme essentially replaced us in many ways. So before lockdowns hit, our average loan size was probably around £25,000. The bounce back loan scheme was up to £50,000. So for businesses, it was a lot more attractive to take those government funds, which came at near zero interest rate and no other covenants attached to them, and that of course was very attractive. So there was much more demand to access these pools of funding than coming to us. That was difficult for us, but at the same time, as we were accredited for this other scheme, where our loan sizes were on average closer to 250, 300,000 pounds, we were able to support a different segment of SMEs that we weren't as present in before the lockdowns. And that meant that we could build a new capability during this period, which is now very valuable to us. So for us, sort of this period, as painful as it was for our customers as well as us, it was also a period where we could grow new capabilities, and we benefit from those very much now.
Yeah, well, I remember it very well. We were launching our consulting business exactly at that time. In fact, we had first fees in January of 20. I'm afraid I didn't know about iWalker at the time, but we got a COVID loan courtesy of Starling Bank. It was the same day. I was quite impressed at the time, thinking that happened quickly. I don't think that was everyone else's experience. I know there's been a lot of scrutiny since on lending decisions by all sorts of lenders during that period. So some of the processes were a bit rushed. But I like that point about how it sort of matured your offerings and allowed you to add capability. I'm curious, what are the highs and lows? You said roller coaster journey. And I'll ask you in a few minutes about some of the lessons you've learned. But the ride that you've been on with iWalker, perhaps it'd be great to hear a couple of things that have maybe been a peak experience and a couple of things that may have given you a really, really difficult obstacle.
Yeah, I mean, the last 15 years just has been a bit of a roller coaster for everyone. It's, it's a very fast-paced world with a lot of geopolitical events that happened over those 15 years. And, before I go into some of those, I started by saying that, we were excited by helping individual small businesses to access financing, to do this a million times over, and to use tech and data to solve that problem. Throughout sort of this roller coaster period, these were the three constants all the way to today that always kept us focused, kept us going. And that stability in knowing which problem we're trying to solve and what it takes to solve it, I think was really critical for us to stay kind of, in the right lane and move in the right direction. So things that we, worked through in the early days, we've had the European government crisis with, Greece being bailed out. That led to a lot of turmoil, as you remember. It was during a time where we had to raise funding. We were loss making at the time. We were highly reliant to raise more funding to be able to build out the business and continue to fund our growth. If you're kind of in a period where at that point the world went into a difficult spot, that sort of immediately puts you in a very precarious position, and that was quite troublesome. Then Brexit was of course another one. A lot of uncertainty for an extended period of time. If you remember 2019 period, where I wasn't sure whether it would be a hard Brexit, no Brexit, soft Brexit. It was just like the whole population and certainly businesses were very worried, as we were. And usually kind of, these things kind of lead to worse access to funding. And again, as a fast-growing businesses like ours, where you're relying on quite heavily on external funding, these are very nerve-wracking periods. And then, COVID, we already discussed. And then post-COVID, our businesses obviously had to trade through a period with very high inflation. Inflation in the double digits was the highest that, I ever experienced in my lifetime. You might remember the October where Liz Truss was prime minister. That was, again, a period where we were raising capital, which was very, very, very difficult by politicians. And now sort of we have another geopolitical crisis. So I think kind of like the roller coaster period were generally kind of because of some geopolitical events that were generally caused by politics, really, rather than by businesses. So I think if you would take sort of those sort of events out, it would have been, a very concentrated path on solving the problem. But, we kind of had to work around sort of those and make sure that we do raise the funding that we need to be able to do our jobs.
Yeah, and to many extents, chaos is the new normal. So unfortunately, I have to believe that there are more shocks around the corner and that the roller coaster is likely to continue.
Yeah, what is to me really amazing is to see how resilient small business owners are. It's just, you know, regardless how rough the conditions are, they'll figure out a way how to trade through them, slightly pivot at times, or just cut down on cost where needed. And if needed, you know, the last 10 years, they've been thrown sort of from one crisis seemingly to another, and they're still going strongly.
And so let's talk about your clients a little bit, your customers a little bit. I mean, I guess that there may not be a typical client because there are so many mid-market businesses types out there. But if I was to ask you that question, typical iWalker client, I mean, I'm interested, maybe it's a restaurant or is it a beauty salon or something? I mean, can you tell us a bit about the customer base?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There is nearly not like a typical client because we are providing funding all the way from a few hundred pounds through iWalker Pay, which is our B2B buy now, pay later solution, now used by more than 10,000 businesses to purchase from their suppliers, all the way to £1 million, our maximum loan amount that we're lending, which is attractive to small and medium-sized businesses. If you take our sort of, you know, if you were to say a typical customer, like the majority of our customers are taking funding below £25,000, so just by count, that is representative of how many of them there are. But then, you know, we're funding a large volume also at the other spectrum of the larger ones. So I think, you know, it's more, I think what is special about what we've built is that we're able to cater to all of these different segments and that we've built technology that is enabling us to provide all of these businesses a fantastic service and one that they wouldn't get anywhere else. So on the smaller end, we're fully automated. You know, I alluded to that more than 80% of our customers get an immediate credit decision, which is up to £50,000. And then, you know, when we go up to £1 million, we have built systems that enable us to ingest some human intelligence into our system, which is then used by our systems to generate a credit decision. These are very, very different platforms that we made and built to work very harmoniously together, so that even for £1 million, we might be able to give our customers a decision within a few hours from them applying. And to cover kind of, you know, who our customers are, we have a decent decent allocation of our funding goes to construction. That's about 20% of the funding that we originate, and we're very active in that part of the economy. But equally, kind of larger for us, the hold services sector, hospitality, you know, restaurants and hotels are a big sector for us, as is retail and warehousing. So, you know, we do cater pretty much to every industry in the economy.
Yeah, multi-sector. So you touched on technology, and this is a fintech conversation, so let's go there. Were you always a technology company with an automation, a data strategy from the start, or has that more evolved with the technology capabilities that have clearly evolved in the wider market rapidly over the period that you've been running the business?
No, day one, we saw us as using technology and data to solve the problem. So from day one, our ambition was to make automated decisions for everyone that we're funding. And it was only over the course of time that we realized that there's quite a bit of value by funding larger businesses where, you know, where full automation is not leading to the best credit decisions, as we do get some signal by looking at elements that are just very difficult to automate. And we automate more and more of them as we get more data. But you have to start sort of some manual underwriting to be able to deliver this. To give you an example, imagine kind of a customer comes to us that turns over £1 million, and that £1 million is from exactly one customer. You would say that's a fairly kind of high concentration. But if that customer is the NHS, then it's a fantastic counterpart. But if the contract with the NHS is expiring in 6 months, then obviously that's a huge kind of cliff, and it's unclear whether the business will ever be able to refill that revenue. So, you know, this is just one example, but it's not obvious how you automate all of these steps without having necessarily the information available to make that assessment. And that's kind of where a lot of our IP lies, is how we manage that process of getting some information in that you can't necessarily automatically ingest, but still use the same sort of machine learning models to optimize how we ultimately then take credit decisions based on the information that has been included into our system.
So it's sort of hybrid AI and data-driven and human process, depending on the size and nature of the borrower. Can you just walk us, let's talk about that a little bit, about what actually happens. That 24 hours, or an example you gave a few minutes ago, 2 minutes if it's really quick. So a client comes onto your website and they're looking for a business loan. What are the steps? Which data and what data are you taking into the system, either from them or from other market sources, in order to make a lending decision?
So for any customer that comes to us, the first bit that we would use is data from credit reference agencies, from various ones, from public registers like Companies House and other public registers. We would also, in the majority of cases, receive their bank statement history, which has a huge amount of relevant data on their business, and complement that with some proprietary information that we have into the very large data warehouse that we have now after 15 years. We've done more than 380,000 loans over these 15 years. Most of them, of course, sort of over the last 5 years or so. And so through that wealth of data that we have on literally hundreds of thousands of customers and sort of the loan experiences, we're able sort of to combine that, all of that information, outcome information, as well as sort of the information we receive. So loan outcome information, as well as the information that we receive from new customers, to, in most cases, provide an instant credit decision. When customers are larger, then we might ask them for additional information that might also include their management accounts, that might include their debtor list, that we then use to digest that information and add it to the system. But again, as I explained earlier, we never have a person make a credit decision. A person is only adding information to our system. And then it's the algorithms that we built based on the data that we have that ultimately makes a credit decision. That's basically the process. You know, where a company is larger and we might ask for an additional data point from them that then, you know, might take a few hours more on that data to be sent to us, and then, you know, for someone to review that data, which is, you know, largely done in an automated way, but then make some judgment on that data, which goes into then our data warehouse.
Yeah, so you've been using machine learning algorithms for over a decade. The last 3 years have all been around generative AI, and last year much excitement about agentic AI, and this year firms starting to deploy agents into production. How does that sit with your roadmap, and are you now finding there's you could do a lot more and you're building agents, or you've perhaps felt that you're sort of already there because you've built your bespoke narrow AI models and it's working? Just curious, sort of how much the agentic era is going to provide an opportunity for you now.
So I think the fully agentic way of building credit models, we're not quite there yet. The main benefit we have observed, you know, over the last year and sort of accelerated over the last few months, is just how much faster we can do data analysis with the new tools that are given to us. And that sort of just enables us to test and work on many more things in the same period of time that we would have done otherwise. So the learning process is accelerated quite significantly. You know, a next step would be to have agents talk to each other rather than humans sort of talk to an agent sort of to do parts of our work, but we're not quite there yet.
And this all needs to be done clearly on auditable guide rails and treating customers fairly. And there's a huge element of AI safety and ethics that overlays on the agentic world So not to be taken lightly. And I think it's going to be an incremental progress. So let's talk about business models a bit, because at the top of the conversation, I sort of threw in the phrase co-opetition, which is this sort of cooperation competition model. And when you were starting out, I remember that sort of first wave of disruptive fintechs, and there were several lending startups. And I remember going to a panel discussion at the LSE with one of them. I think they were called LendInvest, and they were doing real estate backed investments. And it was the first time I'd heard this model of a disruptive lender acting as a distribution arm for one of the big incumbents. And you'd think they'd be in competition, but they said, oh, no, I guess that's where I get my money from. You know, I get 200 million from Goldman's or from whoever. And we're acting as an innovative and rapid additional distribution channel for those established businesses. And I think listening to what you were saying about the way Iwaka works, that's very much part of your model. But what's your take on this co-opetition model, and the fact that I think the stats are right, the specialist lenders like yourselves are now doing the majority of the SME lending in the market, and it's not the established firms.
Yeah, it's a fantastic cooperation that we were able to forge with some of them, and you know, generally all of them are doing this in some shape or form. We we are incredibly good at serving customers through the experience that we're able to give them, and that's a function of the technology that we've built, the way how we're using data and so forth, as we have discussed. But they have all the capital. I mean, in the end, you know, banks have the cheapest cost of capital, and they are now able to provide us with that capital and therefore use their strengths, and we use ours. And that means, a team, we're delivering the best experience to businesses. So I think it's really kind of a fantastic partnership where, you know, each side is adding a lot of value. Create the best outcomes.
And is that the whole of models? So your funding sources essentially are blocks of capital from the big lenders. I mean, is that really sort of the whole thing? Or is there another source of capital or some of your own funds or something that you're doing that's in the mix as well?
So banks are providing the bulk of capital. They provide the liquidity. We're also working with credit funds that take a more subordinated position in our funding vehicles. And then, of course, we are providing our own capital as well. So in all lending that we do today, we are the principal lender, we're the risk taker, and then we have supplemental funding sources that provide us with the liquidity. And then, you know, our credit, mezzanine credit funds, they have a higher yield by taking somewhat more risk than the banks that generally sort of take a senior position.
And is there an element of embedded lending with your API? Maybe this was fundamentally part of the model, as has always been, as the handshake between you and the capital providers. But I'm curious, are you sort of lending your underwriting algorithms and your technology to other firms as an embedded service?
Great question. So, you know, if I look at our 15-year history, the way I kind of quite like to describe it is we have built a Formula One great SME lending platform. And, you know, very tech oriented with teams that are really combining skills between technology, data science, and commercial skills, working on every part of that car. And that's sort of a continuous monitoring and optimization process, just as you would expect from a sort of fantastic racing stable. And that's the core of what we've built over 15 years. In sort of 2015, 16, we realized that it's quite expensive to build a brand. So you asked me kind of, you know, how excited were customers about this? Yeah, the people that were using us, they were very excited. But to really get your name out, you need to invest vast amounts of marketing. And being more tech-led, that wasn't necessarily our strengths to sort of embark on a speculative marketing brand campaign through TV, out-of-home campaigns. So we started using technology to embed us into other platforms so that businesses didn't have to come to us or respond to our own marketing, but we'd rather sort of brought the financing to the places where they actually are at every day. So that included accountancy platforms like Xero, include strategic partners like eBay that, you know, fund customers directly through their account, where we fund directors directly through their account pages, again, in real time. Also take repayments through eBay. In this example, We're in marketplaces, which became ever more prominent, both for consumers as well as then also businesses, so that someone searching for a loan on the internet went through an aggregator, got a live quote from us within a few minutes. So all of this was part of an embedded financing strategy, which aimed to bring our financing to our customers rather than having them come to us. And now, you know, if we speak a little bit, and, you know, that has scaled enormously over the last, 8 years since we launched it with our first partner, which was Tide. But we're looking at the future now. We're taking this one step further, and we're now building our own services in which we are embedding financing. And so our next sort of phase of development is a more vertical integration into the SME economy. As an example, we have launched a platform for SMEs. Big problem, businesses find it really hard in the segment to sell their business. You have a huge cliff of people who are in their 60s who are looking to sell their business, but there's no real advisor available at that scale. And so the process often is, people don't know how to sell their business in the end. Equally, lots of buyers, lots of SMEs would like to buy another company, but it's really hard to actually find one. And make it work. So we launched an M&A platform and have embedded acquisition finance into this platform. We have launched a credit health score where businesses can understand, monitor, and we give them pointers how to improve their credit score so that access to financing is more easy for them in the future. We are launching an SME insurance brokerage because I feel that this is a market that is ripe for innovation. And I think that we'll have a TransferWise moment over the next 24 months, and we'll embed premium financing in our offering from the start. And we're also launching a credit card for businesses, which will have a lot of ancillary service attached to them. So our next chapter of evolution is really one where we go much broader into the SME economy, build, solve problems that are largely unsolved today, and provide financing from within. And that's sort of like a really exciting prospect. Every year has been different sort of over the last 15 years, but the next few years, being able to scale all of those, some might win, some might fail, but that's sort of like the next challenge that I'm looking forward to.
Well, I love that. I mean, you've built such a foundation, and I was going to ask you where it's all going next, but I wasn't expecting that answer necessarily. So I would love to have been a fly on the wall for that whiteboard session, because you go, I've got 380,000 loans. I've got this ecosystem and client base, many of whom are similar types of businesses. A big media agency, a middling big media agency might want to buy a small one, for example. And there'll be turnover, as you say, of people, life events, retiring, wanting to sell up. And that finding and then conveyancing of a big business is a complex end-to-end workflow, and there's financing, there's valuation, there's asset handovers, there's all sorts of things that sit in there. And that was just one of your ideas there. So I can imagine sort of putting the client base at the center and kind of spidering out all sorts of ideas about where you could go into these vertical market segments and particular offerings. So I could sort of tell you maybe you're having some fun with that.
Yeah, in a way we're kind of quite fortunate timing wise. We're quite profitable, so we're able to fund those new ventures from our own funds. We don't need to raise funds. We have, as you mentioned, a very vast network of SMEs that we can tap into. Last year we had in total 750,000 businesses applying for funding from us. We have quite a bit of data on these businesses, and we're able to implement those new ventures much faster due to the emergence of AI and Cloud Code. It takes us a lot fewer resources that can go much faster than we would have done even a year or 2 years ago. And that sort of makes it really interesting to supercharge that vertical integration at this point, where we really start from a pretty clean sheet and can just see kind of how far we get over the next 5 years. But I think, it's a real kind of potential for us to build we've already been transformative in some ways, but I think kind of there's a whole new level of transformation that we can drive over the next few years to grow the SME economy in the way that we could have never imagined when we started.
Yeah, and it sounds like that opportunity is accelerating as well. The investors look for a J curve in the returns. And you said most of the loans you made were in the last 5 years, and they are opening up a whole load of new strategic growth initiatives. And it's not the first time crawl code has come up in conversations. I mean, the things that people are building out pace, certainly with this year's models, which have become a lot stronger, has just sort of lit a fire under all of these opportunities.
Yeah, fully agree.
Excellent. Well, we're on the same wavelength then. So let's switch this just as we wrap up, perhaps on things that you've learned along the way. So you've been on a roller coaster, you know, built a substantial business and now opening up a whole new suite of business opportunities into your market. What have you learned along the way? You know, what would be perhaps your one thing that you wish you'd learned that you knew at the start?
It's really hard. Most days are really hard. So, you know, I didn't expect it when I started to be so hard, and it's been 15 years now. And you're just, every day kind of, you'll have sort of to push yourself a little bit further up the mountain. And then this view is obviously getting ever better the higher you go, but it's a very hard path up there.
I can echo that. I'm a founder myself. We run a consulting business, and you just don't know at the beginning how hard it's going to be. And we have lots of examples of stories of things that went sideways or we weren't expecting. And I'm sure you do as well. But I always say it's 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration building something. And if you are a would-be entrepreneur out there, you really need to think about the effort and the resilience that needs to be involved, right? Even with AI, you can't just throw a few claw bots at something and expect that it's going to succeed. There's some really heavy lifting.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely, it does feel a bit like a very kind of long and challenging hike. Also very exciting, obviously, kind of like with all achievements that we have made. I do think kind of life became a little bit easier when we became profitable, because you don't have necessarily every day that existential threat anymore, that, you know, I need money in 6 months. If I don't have that money, you kind of know these are the consequences of running out of money. And, you know, they're just incredibly stressful. So I'm very, very glad that we're currently beyond sort of that threshold, and hopefully will continue to be. And then, you know, the second thing is, like, I think any kind of CEO is always is incredibly worried about everything. You know, I like sort of this analogy to a racing car. You might be in pole position, but you actually only have one when you're over the finish line. You could, you know, your tire could blow up, as it did in many cases in the last lap, or your engine could sort of crash. So you're constantly kind of thinking about what can go wrong, you know, what are the things that I could possibly preempt over the next year or two or next few months. And I think that's a skill that, you know, served me quite well, to just always be somewhat paranoid about the future. So I generally, given the roller coaster we've been through, I never take anything for granted. That also sort of keeps us as a business somewhat more grounded. We have humble as one of the values or behaviors we're looking in people when they're joining. I think that humility, that, you know, next quarter could be our last one, is still one that I think is a really good one to have, that I kind of learned to, never kind of stop worrying about the future. You know, also future, but I'm sort of, it's a balance, like, you know, there's always like half doubt, half excitement.
Yeah, and I think being sort of professionally cautious, I think, is important, and that humility is so important. When the sort of the confidence and the assumptions run away with you, that's probably the warning sign that something's about to go wrong. And I think usually it does. So, and the people that you meet and work with while you're on your journey, you're always going to run into them again. And sometimes it's, very quickly, and sometimes it's years later. So just sort of having that humility and dealing with people with a bit of integrity on the way, it goes an awful long way, I think. It's probably a good segue. I normally open these conversations asking people how they decompress. So we're talking about balance and humility and sort of how hard it can be. Curious, Christoph, what do you do to sort of reset and decompress when you're not, because you clearly do think about the business all the time, but what do you do to give yourself a bit of clear space?
I like running quite a bit. Running, hiking, just moving around. I generally kind of think it's sort of quite good. And I'm doing quite a bit of that. And also just like sometimes to let my hair down, like a good party, loud music, just a really good vibe. I think that sometimes helps to decompress. Not every week, but yeah.
Still attending the old rave. Fantastic. Look, we're going to run out of time. So just sort of as we wrap this up, any advice for would-be fintech entrepreneurs out there? I mean, you are so far on your journey and clearly have had a few twists and turns on the way, but is there any advice that you'd give to folks who are thinking of starting up their own thing?
Well, lots of advice that, you know, I can give from my own experience might be valuable or not for someone else. Every situation is also different. But I think the number one advice I would give, initially I thought, like probably many founders, you start something and you might be doing this for a few years and then sort of you sell it and then you move on. And my advice would be, don't do that. Just sort of keep on building and see this as a very, very, very long journey, because it just compounds. Like, you know, everything that you're building at kind of in the sort of business becomes bigger and bigger, that it's really worthwhile to hang in there for, you know, for me now 15 years. And yes, kind of in these 15 years, you know, periods where you absolutely hate it. But so my advice would be, try to build a business for a lifetime rather than just, you know, for a quick sale. I think that in general is a bit of a problem, that most people just try sort of to build, make money and move on. But I think it's
having an eye on the exit before you start. So I always say build for value, and it gives you choices on the journey. So you have those choices, you know, once you're into profit and you've got scale. And I love that point about it compounding, because we see that sort of resilience. And if you survive through a downturn and all of the time and the investment that you and the team are putting in, it does compound and it builds platform, it builds brand, it builds customer base, and it sometimes comes back to you in surprising ways.
Yeah. And they're all, you know, if you look at the most successful companies that, you know, started in the early, you know, 2000s, the value that kind of they have today versus the value that they had after 5, 6, even 10 years is just on a, you know, astronomically different level. That is, I think, from a value creation, the compounding that you can get. But as a founder, it's also just the pleasure of the growing impact that you have on you know, on customers, on being able to, you know, serve them in more and different ways and many more of them. So that would be my advice. Just you know, keep building on.
Anything that's on your reading list or your listening list currently that you'd recommend?
Yeah, reading is something I'd love to do more. There's just so much information I have to digest every day from various sources that the actual kind of reading for pleasure is falling a bit short. The last book I read was the 1929 recap of the history of the market crash that then caused the Great Depression. It's been an okay book, really, overall, I'd say. But there's sort of just one sort of really good lesson from it. It's generally caused when people get too greedy and when there's too much leverage in the system. So, you know, this, I guess, kind of has been sort of one of the key causes back then, has been a key cause for other crises thereafter, and will continue to be that way. So we're trying to manage our walker with a leverage that is very sustainable. It's just a good book as a reminder that if you're getting too greedy, then the risk of failing increase.
Yeah, cautionary note. So don't be too greedy. That's some great advice and wisdom from, you know, 15 plus years in business there from Christoph. And I think we'll wrap it up there. If folks want to find out more about you on the business, presumably website, LinkedIn.
Yeah, please reach out, LinkedIn.
Very good. Thank you. Look, Christoph, thanks for coming on the show, and great conversation about the business and your journey, and wishing you all the success in the future.
Thank you very much, Tony.